We're going to continue our discussion today. Let me refresh your memory what we're talking about. We're talking about family relationships, and particularly now what we're talking about is the position of women in Israel, particularly the wife and the mother. And we were mentioning how that in the Bible we find that the husband, of course, was the head of the family, and the wife was subject or subservient to the father, but she still exercised great authority in the family. And then we were talking about how the fact that the position of Jewish women was much superior to that of other heathen women in other civilizations. And we mentioned that amongst the Arabs a woman was a thing, and amongst the Greeks, Grecian philosophy was such that a woman was inferior just because she was a woman, just by virtue of her very sex. Immediately that made her inferior. And then also the Romans taught the same basic type of idea. And then we also mentioned that by Jesus' day, Jewish culture was diverted really far from God's truth regarding the treatment of women. And so when we talk about these customs in connection with women, we're not trying to really foster low self-esteem amongst you. And really, God was not trying to do that in the Old Testament. You see, we're reading the same Bible that the Jews read. And we're not getting that impression on how women should be treated. They were getting this, of course, probably a lot of it from the devil and from other cultures and so forth, and because of their own religious misconcepts. And so when we talked about the rabbis praying daily, "Oh, blessed art thou, O Lord God of the universe, who has not made me a woman," and they would start off their day praying that. Well, see, that was not God's heart in them. That was their own religious misconcept. And when we talked about the rabbis, how they wouldn't speak with women and they wouldn't touch women or they wouldn't allow themselves to be touched by women, and the reason why they considered women to be the root of all of men's struggle with impurity and everything. Really what that is, that's the old pass the buck routine. That's where, well, I can't live a pure life, so someone else is to blame, and because this is my sin, then they're to blame. Well, see, that doesn't really hold up before God. And so that's not in accordance to God's word. Now, there was a particularly meticulous group of Pharisees known as the bleeding Pharisees. The bleeding Pharisees. Now, what they did, they closed their eyes whenever they noticed a woman approaching. They were devout. They were holy. They closed their eyes so as not to look on her and be tempted. They wanted to be pure. Well, consequently, they often bumped into things, and they became bloody. And so they called them the bleeding Pharisees. And you see, this is why Jesus appeared on the scene, and all Jesus went right to the heart of the matter. He said, "You've heard it been said by them in the Old Testament that whosoever commits adultery is guilty of sin. But I say unto you, whosoever looks on a woman to lust after her, he has committed adultery with her already in his heart." And then he talked about plucking out your right eye and cutting off your right hand and so forth. And what he was doing, they were exempting themselves. They were feeling like, well, if I don't actually do it, then, you know, that exonerates me and everything. And Jesus was saying, "Oh, no, no, no. Don't try to put the blame on anyone else. It's your heart that's impure. It's your heart that's unregenerate. It's your heart. You need to repent and not blame it on someone else." But at any rate, by the time of Jesus, women were not allowed to be witnesses in Jewish courts at that time. The witness of a woman was not valid because they considered all women liars. That's what they believed. They felt like all women were liars. And the reason why? Because of Sarah's behavior back in the book of Genesis, back in Genesis chapter 18 and verse 12. Remember when the Lord appeared to Sarah back in Genesis 18 and said that you're going to bear a son and so forth, and she laughed. And the angel of the Lord said, "Why are you laughing?" And she said, "Well, it's not, I believe. I wasn't laughing. And she denied the fact that she was laughing. And so the rabbis interpreted that to mean that all women from now on are therefore liars, and their witnesses cannot be accepted. Well, see, that really is reading into the Bible something that is not there. I can think of a lot of men in the Bible that were liars, like Ahab of Israel and others that were liars, Judas Iscariot, and, you know, it's not like the luminaries of heaven are going to shine in eternity with great brightness, and they're all men, and the women are all inferior. That's not the picture whatsoever. Well, let's go on and talk about the birth and care of children briefly. The first thought is that Jewish women longed for and rejoiced in giving birth to children. They wanted children. They loved children. And, of course, generally speaking, families loved children, wanted children. Rachel said in Genesis chapter 30 and verse 1, she said, "Give me children or I die." I've heard women nowadays say statements like that. But Genesis chapter 30, verse 1, give me children or I die. See, she desired it. Now, furthermore, they looked at bearing children as a fulfillment of God's commandment given back in Genesis chapter 1. Remember what God said in Genesis chapter 1? He told Adam and Eve, be fruitful and multiply and replenish the earth and fill the whole earth. And so what they felt like, this is a holy commandment from God. This is something that God has given us, and we are to have children. God wants us to. And furthermore, the law of God taught that children were a sign of God's blessing. The more children you had, the more blessed you were. And, for example, in Deuteronomy chapter 28 and verse 4, it says, blessed shall be the fruit of thy body if you walk with me, is what it is implying. Deuteronomy 28, verse 4. And then notice the picture of the godly man in Psalm chapter 127 here. Psalm chapter 127 in verse 3. Here's what it says. Picture of the godly person. Godly man of God. Talks about the righteous, that children are an heritage of the Lord, and the fruit of the womb is his reward. As arrows are in the hand of the mighty man, so are children of the youth. Happy is the man that has his quiver full of them. They shall not be ashamed, but they shall speak with the enemies in the gate. In other words, this righteous man, he's going to have many quivers in his, he's going to have many arrows in his quiver, many offspring, many children. And if he's a godly man, and if they are raised correctly, see, they'll bring him honor, and he won't be ashamed in the gates. He won't be ashamed amongst his peers. Now, furthermore, when a woman was barren, that was a sign of reproach. If they were barren and they could not bear children, that was considered a great embarrassment. It was a very touchy issue. It was a very sensitive type thing. It was considered to be either a curse or a form of God's judgment that had come on them. And it was something that brought many women in the Old Testament a great deal of grief. Case in point was Rachel. Here was Rachel, and she was, of course, the co-wife along with Leah. And Leah had given birth to children, and Rachel hadn't been able to. And that was a great grief after many years had gone by. We read of godly Hannah in 1 Samuel chapter 1, verse 6, that she wanted a child so bad. And I think, again, it was involved with another woman there, Peninnah, maybe, was a co-wife. Wasn't Peninnah a co-wife of Hannah? And Peninnah had bore children, and yet Hannah hadn't been able to in 1 Samuel chapter 1, verse 6. And so when she did, God took away the reproach from her. Also in Luke chapter 1, verse 25, godly Elizabeth, who was the wife of Zacharias, who both of them gave birth to John the Baptist. Well, in Luke 1:25, she talks about God took away her reproach. Now, it's also interesting to note about Oriental philosophy that there was a basic preference for a male child. You can imagine with the mentality that they were fostering about the position of a woman and so forth, they desired a male child. In fact, there was an Arab and Oriental blessing that read like this. When they would bless other people. May the blessings of Allah be upon thee. May your shadow never grow less. May all your children be boys and no girl. Well, of course, if that happened, you know, what would happen to the race? They were all boys. Remember when you were a kid and you used to argue maybe with your friend and who's more important, a boy or a girl or a mom or dad or whatever? Well, you need both of them. I mean, both are vital, obviously. But the reason that boys were wanted, primarily by the Jews, is the fact that the lineage was carried on by the male, not the female. Obviously, when a female marries, she loses her name, the surname. The surname is not carried on. She's married, she takes her husband's name upon herself, and so the father's name is therefore lost. But if you have a boy, your boy will carry on your name, and therefore carry on your inheritance, and carry on the family. And furthermore, boys would increase the size and the wealth and the importance of the family, because when they married, very often they would move in with their parents. That was very customary, that when you had children and you maybe had a couple sons, they would get married, and they would not just instantly go off and build their own home. They'd move in with you. And the larger your family was, that was a sign of great blessing. It was a sign of great wealth and a relatively good sign of power. And yet if you had a girl, when she got married, she left your family. She decreased the size of your family. She wasn't available to help around the home any longer. She couldn't grind the grain. She couldn't do all the things that she normally did. And so therefore, there was a basic desire and preference to have a male child. Furthermore, the Hebrew women desired to give birth to the Messiah. And that was kind of a burning hope within their heart. It was latent within them. They felt, maybe I will be the one that will bear Messiah. Maybe I will be the one that will give birth. And so the messianic promises were alive in their hearts, and they wanted to fulfill that promise of the coming of Messiah. Now, they did have an interesting custom in connection with the birth of a child. When a child was born, right when the mother was in childbirth, they would have two or three local musicians. And these musicians would usually wait outside. And they would stand outside with their instruments, and they were waiting the news, whether it was a baby or a girl. Now, if it was a boy, they would immediately beat their drums and play musical instruments amidst singing, and it was a joyous celebration. However, if it was a girl, the musicians would walk away silently, and they wouldn't play anything. They would leave the house silently, and they would leave with sad faces. That was part of it. And everyone knew what happened. You know, Brother Elisha over there gave birth to a girl. In fact, furthermore, even the grandparents, very often the grandparents would refuse to visit this new daughter, wouldn't visit her because she brought discredit to the family. Now, talking about putting your pants on backwards or whatever, what a way to get started in life. The Talmud taught this. They said, the birth of a male child causes universal joy, but the birth of a female child causes universal sorrow. And that's what they taught. And so the women did have that to contend with throughout their life. And yet you look at the Savior, and he was so different from all that. Because here you find him talking to the Samaritan woman. First of all, not even supposed to be talking to a Samaritan. Furthermore, talking to a woman, furthermore, talking to her when he is considered to be a rabbi, and taking an interest in her and so forth. Jesus did this over and over again. He ministered to the women. And I'm sure that many of them felt that ministry coming from him. Now, furthermore, we find that as far as care of the infants, once they were born, as soon as the child was born, they would wash the child, obviously, and they would rub his skin with salt. I'm not sure what that does. It does something to their skin. I was told by someone that it tightens their skin. I'm not sure if that's exactly what it does, but they rub their skin with salt, and then they would take their legs, and they would wrap their legs together with their arms at their side, and they would wrap them tightly in a long linen bandage. Often this bandage was like 15 or 18 feet in length, and so it was a long bandage. They wrapped them up like a mummy with their hands right to their side. And so, therefore, there wasn't a great deal of mobility amongst the child. Of course, they left the face exposed. They didn't wrap that up. They were probably tempted to a couple times, but they didn't wrap the face up. You can read about this in Exodus chapter 16, verses 3 through 5. If you ever sat in the view room, you know what I'm talking about there. But Ezekiel chapter 16, 3 through 5. Ezekiel, what did I say? I should have said Ezekiel, I'm sorry. Ezekiel 16, 3 through 5, and then also Luke chapter 2 and verse 12. Luke 2:12. Jesus was wrapped in swaddling clothes, and when it talks about the swaddling clothes, that's what it's talking about. Now also, in connection with the birth of the child, there were various Jewish rites and rituals and offerings that took place during the time of the child's birth and shortly thereafter. A Jewish boy, of course, was circumcised the eighth day after he was born, circumcision being the sign of the covenant. And then also there were various offerings that were made in behalf of the woman as a sign of her purification. She was considered unclean after she gave birth to a child. And so she would go to the temple, and if she was rich, she would offer a lamb to the Lord in the temple. And if she was poor, she would offer a couple of pigeons or a couple of turtle doves in the temple. And you'll notice that Mary, the mother of Jesus, offered the turtle doves, indicating that they were a very poor family. That was the best that they had to offer before God. And with that, you can read about the rituals in Leviticus chapter 12 and so forth. Leviticus chapter 12, and there it'll talk about the woman. It is interesting, again, though, when a female was born, the woman was unclean for twice as long. See, and I'm sure that the rabbis capitalized on that as well. Now, as far as naming the children, this was a very, very special thing. It was done with much prayer. It was not done lightly. It was taken very seriously to name a Hebrew child. Normally, if it was a male child, they would try to include either the name of God or the name of Yahweh in the name of the child itself. And many, many people in the Old Testament had either the name of God or Yahweh directly included in their name. For example, The name Azariah, and of course you could go anywhere in the Bible and find this out, but the name Azariah means helped by Yahweh. The name Obadiah means servant of Yahweh. The name Daniel, which is Daniel, see, Daniel means God is my judge. Ezekiel means God will strengthen. So they would normally try to somehow add or include the name of God right in part with the name of the child himself. One author notes about the naming of the child this. He said, quote, "The naming of the child was very important, for it was considered to foretoken, if not actually to influence, the character and accomplishments for which the child was destined," end quote. So they kind of had a feeling like, if you name the child that, that's what he will become. He will become what you name him. And so therefore they had that type of idea connected with the child. Of course, the angel told Mary about the birth of Jesus and said, "Thou shalt name his name Jesus, for he shall save his people from their sins." Jesus means Yahweh the Savior. Now, another common custom in connection with the name was they would say the son's name in connection often with the father's name, especially if your name was a relatively common name. You see, they did not have a surname. They did not have a last name. They only went by first names. Well, obviously, it became necessary at times to distinguish between individuals because you might have a common name, like, for example, Simon. Simon was a very common name. There might be several people, so you would therefore be given your father's name right along with your name as it were, a last name. So, for example, Peter, who is also called Simon, Simon is called Simon Bar-Jonah. Simon Bar-Jonah. And that's found in Matthew chapter 16 and verse 17, I should say. Matthew 16, verse 17. And you see the father's name is there used with Simon's name, and the little Aramaic word bar is affixed to it. The word bar means son of. So what that is saying is Simon, son of Jonah. Jonah was his father. So they would take like your father's first name, and they would call you by your first name, and then they would say son of Robert or something like that, see. And they would call you by that. And sometimes they would give a double name to someone, and this was true of Thomas. You can read of this in John chapter 11 and verse 16. John chapter 11, verse 16. And there it talks about Thomas, who is also called Didymus. So one name was Thomas, the other name was Didymus. Now actually, Thomas means twin in the Aramaic, and Didymus means twin in the Greek. So, see, often the Jews were trilingual, excuse me. They would speak like Aramaic, they would speak Hebrew, and also Greek, too. So your name might be, you know, this name in Greek, and then they'd also have the same name for you in one of the other languages. How about if you were a gal? How about if you were a girl? What would they do here as far as giving you a name? Well, normally with the girls, they did it a little bit differently. They didn't give them a denigrating name or anything like that. But what they'd do, they'd often take something from nature, maybe a beautiful object in nature or a pleasant grace of character, something like this. For example, the name Jemima in the Bible, it means dove, like a beautiful dove. The name Tabitha means gazelle. Of course, a gazelle is like a deer, which again is a beautiful animal. Rhoda is the name Rose. Called her Rose. Rachel means lamb, and Esther means star. So you see, they'd often take something that was from nature, and that's what they would name their little daughter. Well, let's move on. Let's talk about the duty of parents in training their children. What went on as far as actually raising the children? Let's talk about this for a few moments. First of all, the mother did most of the training of the child in the early years. The father undoubtedly was often out busy, either in his trade or out in the farm, farming or whatever. And so the mother did most of the training of both the male and the female in the early years. Daughters remained under the guidance of the mother for their entire period of home life. So the entire time in which the daughter was growing up remained under the tutelage of the mother. However, as the boy grew up, the older he became, the more he came under the influence of his father. And as soon as he could go to work with his father, he went to work with his father. Or as soon as he was old enough to go to, like, for example, synagogue school, he would go to school. But at any rate, he came more and more under his father's influence. So pretty much the daughter was raised by the mother and the son was raised by the father, except for that early period of time. Now, it was only in a real well-to-do family early in Bible history that they could afford to send their child to school or anything like a private tutor. So normally, the children did not go to school as they were being raised, up until the time of the Babylonian captivity. Then it kind of changed. But normally what happened to you is that you learned about the laws of God and you learned about the Word of God from your father. And you grew up learning a trade from your father, but you did not normally go to school. And then we're going to talk about the types of education. And it really differed in between the boys and the girls, as you can imagine. Normally, the girls were not educated. Normally, they were not sent to school. Now, that doesn't mean they were total ignoramuses, because they did go to the synagogue, they did worship God, they did hear the laws of God, but normally, they were not taught officially in a school, where often the male was taught in a school. Let's talk about the education of the youth briefly. Well, first of all, apparently, throughout much of the Old Testament, particularly back during the time of Abraham and Moses, during that time, the home was the school. Children were trained in the home. It says back in Deuteronomy chapter 6 and verses 6 through 9. Deuteronomy chapter 6 and verse 6. Here's what it says. God is admonishing Moses now and saying, "These words which I command thee this day shall be in thine heart, and thou shalt teach them diligently unto thy children, and shalt talk of them when thou sittest in thine house, and when thou walkest by the way, and when thou liest down, and when thou risest up. And thou shalt bind them for a sign upon thine hand, and they shall be as frontlets between thine eyes, and thou shalt write them upon the posts of thy house and on thy gates," and so forth. Which seems to indicate they could read and write. Seems to indicate that they could actually write it. It tells them to write their law on the doorposts of their house. So probably what happened then is that the father took the responsibility to teach the children the laws of God, and the children were instructed in the home. Now, there were other things in their culture that helped train the children educationally. For example, they had the feast days. And three times a year at least now, they would travel all the way down to Jerusalem, and they would go and they would worship God in the temple. And obviously, they were learning things about God when they did that. So they were learning from the priests as they would go and worship the Lord. Now, also, God had a provision in the law that every single seventh year that rolled around, they were to gather all the people together, and they were to read to them the entire law, and they were to teach the law to the people. So once every 7 years now, the people were hearing the law of God that way as well. And of course, the children were involved in that. And then also there were priests and there were Levites scattered throughout the whole land of Palestine. So if you did have a theological question, you could get a hold of either a priest or a Levite, and they would hopefully be able to tell you what the answer to your problem was. So pretty much during the time of Moses and during that period of history, the parents did most of the training of the children. Now, as time went on, there was a school started called the School of the Prophets. School of the Prophets. Now, this was not really started until the time of Samuel. So that's quite a bit later in Israelitish history. But during the time of Samuel, the nation was greatly backsliding very rapidly. And so what Samuel did, he felt it incumbent upon him by the Lord, he started a school for prophets. And he took mostly Levites, apparently, from what I've read about this school, and he would train them to teach the laws of God. Now, they weren't just trained to go out and prophesy, but they were really trained in the laws of God. And so any young man, particularly now if he was of the tribe of Levi, that felt the call of God in their life, they could go to the School of the Prophets, and they evidently had a number of them scattered throughout the land. For example, there appears to have been one at Ramah, over which Samuel presided in 1 Samuel chapter 19 and verse 18 and following. 1 Samuel 19 and verse 18. There also seems to have been one at Gibeah in 1 Samuel chapter 10, verse 5. 1 Samuel 10, 5. In the days of Elijah and Elisha make reference to the school of the prophets and the sons of the prophets. That's what this is talking about. So they did have that. Now, as time went on, particularly when the Jews went to Babylon, remember when we talked about that? The Jews were carried to Babylon for 70 years and they came back from Babylon after that. Well, when they came back from Babylon, they had what were called synagogue schools. And, of course, this was for all the young men that were growing up. It arose during the time of the captivity. When the Jews were in Babylon, it was very evident to them that they weren't teaching their children the laws of God well enough. So when they came back to the Promised Land again, they started what were called synagogues. And they had these synagogues scattered throughout all of Palestine. And so when you were a young man growing up, you instantly were sent to the synagogue. Normally, when you were about 5 or 6 years old, and mom and dad would send you to the synagogue school. And undoubtedly, when Jesus grew up, he was sent to synagogue school and grew up in the synagogue, grew up learning the laws of God in the synagogue. And every single large town had at least one or more synagogues. And even if it was a relatively small town, they also had a synagogue there too very frequently. Normally, the synagogues were presided over by a board of elders or rulers, and then very often a chief rabbi, kind of like the pastor. And this chief rabbi was responsible for that synagogue. So there is Jesus now growing up. And when the Bible says, how does this man know these things, never having learned letters? It's not saying that Jesus was totally unlearned. It doesn't mean that Jesus couldn't read or write or anything like that. What that means is that he had not gone to official rabbinical seminary school. That's what it means. But he evidently was raised going to a synagogue. Normally, as far as the school itself, you were sent there when you were 5 or 6 years old if you were a male. Meanwhile, the female stayed back home and had the glorious task of tending the goats and churning the milk and grinding the grain. But anyway, these young lads went there and went to the synagogue school. And until 10 years of age, the Bible was their only textbook. That's all they studied. They should have made that their only textbook for the entire period of time. But at any rate, for about the first 5 or 6 years or so, they studied the Old Testament. That's all they had during that time. And then when they came to the age of about 10 or 15 years of age, they would study what was called the traditional law. Well, that's where the traditions came in. As far as, you know, Jesus rebuking the Pharisees for their traditions, they spent about 5 years studying the traditions of the elders. And then after that, if you continued on, if you were like over 15 years of age, and if you were really feeling a call to like maybe be a rabbi, then you would go on and you would study what was called the Talmud, which was, again, a Jewish holy book that they would study. And that was only if you really felt that desire. By then, most young boys were firmly established in the trade of their father, and very often were married by then, by the time they were 15 years old. So very often they would not continue their theology after they were 15 years old. However, if you desire to be trained as a rabbi, once you'd studied the Talmud, and now let's say you're in your late teens, then often what you would do, you would be sent to what was called a rabbinical academy. And you would go there and you'd study with the rabbis for a number of years, and then for final training, you'd be sent down to Jerusalem and study under the rabbis there in Jerusalem. And incidentally, there were two rival rabbinical schools of theology, and they were called Hillel and Shammai. The great school of Hillel and the great school of Shammai. Those were two rival rabbinical schools. Hillel is spelled H-I-L-L-E-L, and Shammai or Shammai is spelled S-H-A-M-M-A-I. And actually, they were opposed to each other. They were often at odds with each other. They taught differently on a number of issues, a number of different subjects. Paul apparently attended the school of Hillel. He went to the top school, the school of Hillel. And the greatest of all teachers was there at the school of Hillel. His name was Gamaliel. Who Paul received his instruction from. Actually, the school of Hillel was more liberal than the school of Shammai. Shammai was a lot more conservative. And so here is Paul now. He attended the school of Hillel. He graduated from it. And therefore, when he graduated, Paul was a Pharisee. And that's what the Bible tells us. He was a Pharisee. Jesus apparently never attended these schools, though. It seems like he did not go and attend them. He probably just worked with his father in the carpentry shop. Well, the last point about education is this, is that when the Jews were training their children, what they were really striving for was a complete education, really desirous to train them in every area of life that they could. And what they really used as the bedrock of their foundation as far as their education was the fear of the Lord. That's what they taught more than anything else. They felt like if they could somehow impart this to the young men and also the young daughters, if they could teach them to fear and love God, to depart from evil, to lead a decent, upright life, then everything else would fall in life. And so that's pretty much what their school centered around. So when these young men went to school, they weren't learning about all the other things in life. They weren't studying like math too much. They weren't studying things like science. They were studying basically religion and basically the fear of the Lord. Now, there were also three goals that every Jewish father had for his son. Three different goals. Varies a little bit with the females. The goals were a little bit different for the females, but three goals that every single Jewish father had for his son. I've already alluded to the first one, really. The first goal that every devout Jew had for his son was that his son might know God, that his son might, as it were, know the Holy Scriptures and know the will of God as contained in the Holy Scriptures. And this was a very, very strong desire of the devout Jews. In fact, it says over and over again that the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom, and everything that they were to do was to be centered around the fear of the Lord. You can look in the following scriptures if you desire. For example, you can look in Psalm chapter 111 and verse 10, and you can look in Proverbs chapter 1 and verse 7, and also in Proverbs chapter 9 and verse 10. But the idea is that they were imparting a knowledge to their sons that if you don't order your life according to the fear of the Lord, then you're going to order your life according to foolishness. And what they meant by foolishness is a life lived outside the will of God. Let me read to you what some of the Jewish wise men of old stressed as far as knowing God and the will of God. For example, Josephus said of Moses, quote, "He commanded to instruct children in the elements of knowledge, to teach them to walk according to the laws, to know the deeds of their forefathers," end quote. And later on, Josephus boldly declared, quote, "We take the most pains of all people with the instruction of our children," end quote. So the Jews were very, very careful with their children, raising them up in the fear of God. Normally speaking, they were. Also in the Jewish holy book, Sukkah, in section 42, part A, they say, quote, "As soon as a child can speak, that is after his third year, he is to be instructed in the law by his father." So you were instructed in the laws of God when you were 3 years old. Can you imagine that? Reading the book of Leviticus when you're 3 years old. You ever read that book? I mean, I'm a little bit older than three, and still Leviticus doesn't engage my attention yet. And then there's another rabbi. His name is Rabbi Salomo, and he said, quote, "A father might as well bury his child as neglect his instruction." Another one, Hillel, said, "An ignorant man of the law cannot be truly pious. The more teaching of the law, the more life, the more school, the more wisdom, the more counsel, the more reasonable action." One final one, Rabbi Joseph, who was a priest. He said, quote, "Give thyself trouble to learn the law, for it is not obtained by inheritance." So, you see, it was strongly stressed to learn the law of God. Well, the second goal. The second goal that every Jewish father had for his son was to find his son a trade or a handicraft, some type of skill, some type of vocational livelihood that he could use throughout his lifetime. And you see, the son was trained. They didn't go to school all day. Normally, they only went to school for a half a day. And the rest of the day, they would work with their father and learn a skill from their father. And even high-ranking, very wealthy Jews, even if they were a priest or a very high-ranking rabbi, would often have their son skilled in a livelihood. For example, Paul, here he is a Pharisee, but also a tent maker, which was a very, very valuable trade during that time. Look at Jesus, a carpenter. And you look at Simon, he was a fisherman. And these other men, they had skills that they used to work with their hands. That was a very, very important part of Jewish culture. You had to learn some type of livelihood, normally the same livelihood your father was engaged in order to make your life fruitful. Well, then there's the third goal. Maybe this is the most pleasant of them all. I don't know. But the Jewish father had the, I suppose, formidable task of finding his son an acceptable wife. Normally, that was the job of the father, more so than the job of the young man. Normally, when you were a young child growing up, very often you were promised to a young lassie or a young girl when maybe you were just a child, maybe just 7, 8 years old. You were promised or engaged, as it were, to this girl. And you may have, you know, she may have lived in a different village than you, but somehow your father arranged this for you. And so you grew up, and you knew that you were going to marry this girl. And yet you never spent any time with her. And just one day, when you were maybe 15 years old, they normally married quite young. When you were fairly young, you just had the wedding day, and you'd get married. But the father would be working on this. And also, of course, the young girls, they weren't involved in actually finding a mate for themselves. Their father was trying to find a mate for them as well. And normally what they'd do, normally they would pick a spouse from the same social and the same economic level. In other words, if you were a poor Jew, you really didn't hope in marrying off your son to a wealthy Jewish girl. Or if you were a poor Jewish girl, you didn't really have any hopes of ever marrying anyone really wealthy. Normally, if you were poor, you married someone poor. If you were wealthy, you married someone wealthy. And preferably, they would take another fellow Israelite right from your own tribe. If you were from the tribe of Judah, then you'd probably marry someone from the tribe of Judah. And normally, even a distant relative, a cousin, second cousin, someone like this. So that's one thing that they had to look forward to. So that was going on. Well, later on, we'll talk about some of the marriage customs. They're quite interesting, a lot different. Although I have to admit, this would take the burden off of some cowardly young men that are afraid to go out and tackle the world and date some young ladies. The final point about here, as far as the family relationships and women and young men and so forth, is this. That by the time of Jesus' day, the mental capacities of women were not recognized. Normally, women were looked upon as not being too smart, not having too much upstairs. Normally, a woman was looked upon as someone that belonged in the home, someone that belonged, you know, beating the clothes down in the stream, but not someone that was involved in instruction, not someone that was actually sharp as far as theology is concerned. In fact, they really received very limited religious instruction. They were not, in fact, allowed to study the law of God. They didn't go, and you could not, like, go to a rabbinical seminary and learn about the law. Normally, like I say, they did not attend the synagogues. In fact, again, the Talmud said, quote, it is better that the Torah should be burned than given or taught to a woman. And so that was kind of their mentality. Now, remember, again, that was not the Old Testament view, but rather that was what men had added to it. So that's not how God felt about the whole matter. That kind of gives you a little bit about the family life. Any questions about that? Wouldn't you young ladies like to go back and live during that time? Wouldn't that be interesting to do that for you? Yeah. Uh-huh. Well, you know, a person can be awfully blind, can't they? A person can be awfully blind. In other words, here you've got this woman that's holding the fort down for you, and she's involved in all these things. Our sister is alluding to maybe, for example, Proverbs 31 and so forth, where there is the wise woman, the virtuous woman. She's buying land, she's selling land, she's planting crops, she's, you know, knitting garments, she's caring for all the children, caring for the father. And yet how can they turn around and say someone like that is ignorant? Meanwhile, the men are often, they would often do this, they would go to the gates of the city and converse all day long, kind of like a giant coffee party type thing. And so here are the men in the gates of the city having this superior attitude that, well, you know, women are just a cut below us and they belong at home. And meanwhile, well, what it was is hypocrisy. That's what it is. It's a form of hypocrisy. It's a form of pride. It's a form of subtle pride. But you see, that's just the way women grew up. If you were a woman, you didn't divorce your husband could divorce you. If he wanted to, according to Shammai, according to Hillel, a woman could be divorced at just any instance. Shammai was a little bit more strict on that. But there's no way, if you were a woman, if you ever ended up with someone, that's it. They were your husband for life, regardless of how they treated you. But it didn't work the other way around. The husband could divorce you just like that. See, what we're saying is that the whole culture was just kind of messed up a little bit. Well, let's move on now. Okay, another question.
What about the children?
Well, I'm sure that as they grew up, they undoubtedly learned the trade of their father, whatever his trade was, working in the temple from him. And so they undoubtedly went to synagogue school, and they too learned the things of God if they were a male. But then they would learn their trade from their father. And you would inherit, of course, you know, your father's name and his position as far as working in the temple. Well, it would seem like you would, because like there were three families that had specific details in the tabernacle now. You had Merari, Gershom, and Kohath, and each one of them did a certain detail, like some carried the ark, some carried the covering, some carried the walls, and so forth. And so when your father died, you'd probably just take his place, is what I'm assuming that, but that's probably what they'd do, just take over their father's position. Let's talk about another ancient empire now. Let's skip a Bible custom, and let's go back and talk about another ancient empire. So remember, we listed the seven ancient empires for you: Egypt, Assyria, Babylon, Medo-Persia, Greece, Rome, and then the future one, of course, I said seven. I guess there were only six ancient ones. The seventh one is going to be a future one, which isn't ancient because it's in the future, which is the Antichrist one. So we won't study that one. Sign up for Apocalypse Daniel. Get it there. But let's talk about the Kingdom of Persia. Kingdom of Persia. Very interesting country. Very interesting culture. Persians ruled Palestine during the last century of Old Testament history. If you were to read the last 100 years of history in the Bible, as far as the book of Malachi and Ezra and Nehemiah and so forth, you would be reading about Persian history, because that's what we're really looking at. In fact, Persian history is mentioned in connection with the following books: Ezra, Nehemiah, Esther, and Daniel. So when you read those books, Ezra, Nehemiah, Esther, and Daniel, those are all taking place, for the most part now, with a few exceptions, during Persian history. Of course, northern Israel is long since gone by now. They were carried off by Assyria way back in 722 B.C. They never came back to land again. But Judah had been in Babylon for 70 years, and then it was Persia that defeated Babylon. And when Babylon was defeated, the Persian became the world empire, and the Persians allowed the Jews to come back into the promised land again. So for Judah, this was a time of restoration and reconstruction, rebuilding the walls of Jerusalem and the temple. Now, over a 650-year period of time, Palestine was dominated by the world empires of Babylon, Persia, Greece, and Rome. But out of all of those empires, when you look at Babylon, Persia, Greece, and Rome, only the Persians are remembered for their contributions to the Jews. Only the Persians are remembered in a favorable light. Only the Persians are remembered for their clemency to the Jews. The other empires were all considered evil and hostile. But the Persians are looked upon in a different light, namely because they allow the Jews to go back and rebuild their temple and even help them. Now, the Persian Empire was much vaster than any of the other ancient empires. If you look at Egypt, or if you look at Assyria, or look at Babylon, it was much, much greater in size. In fact, it extended eastward to India and reached all the way over to Greece. Again, we don't have a real good map here, but if you were to look on a map, it extends all the way over from India. India is way over here. So we're talking about this entire period, entire stretch of land, all the way across here, all the way up to Greece, and even right up to Greece, and all the way down into Egypt itself. And of course, Egypt only occupied this expanse, Babylon just this expanse, and over into Palestine, and Assyria up over into here, but Persia actually occupied the whole area, all the way up to Greece. Very, very large area of expanse. As a world empire, it lasted about 200 years from 536 to 331 B.C., about 200 years, 536 to 331. Well, it occupied, of course, the whole area of what is now known as modern Persia today. See, unfortunately, this map just, someone needs to draw the other half to it because we're off the map. But as far as this area, of course, no one occupied this. This is all desert. But they occupied all the Fertile Crescent. They occupied all this area along the Caspian Sea. They occupied this whole area of Asia Minor. And then they actually tried to conquer Greece. And they didn't actually ever fully conquer Greece, but they occupied the land right up to Greece. Does anyone know the name of the modern country today called ancient Persia? Which one is that? Yeah, it's the modern country of Iran. Iran. It's been called Iran ever since 1935. That's spelled I-R-A-N, Iran. Anciently, it was known as Parsis, the same country, which is spelled P-A-R-S-I-S, Parsis. but it's been known as Persia ever since 1935. Now, I've got a rather complicated little piece of history to share with you. So I'm going to go through it, first of all, and I'm going to share it with you, and then I'm going to draw a little sketch on the board, and hopefully the sketch on the board will help clarify what I'm saying. After you see it a couple times, it's not so complicated. But I'd like to talk about the formation of the Persian Empire briefly. But first of all, it was populated by a group of people called the Aryans, who were Indo-European people. That's spelled A-R-Y-A-N-S. And they moved into the area of the Persian Gulf from various portions of Europe and so forth. And by about 700 B.C., there were two distinct nations that were established, Media and Persia. Two different nations. This is how you spell Media. And that's spelled M-E-D-I-A, Media and Persia. And they came from the ancient Aryans. Well, they were also at this time under Assyrian domination. Remember the Assyrian Empire that we talked about, that cruel empire? It was the Assyrians that were the world empire in 700 BC. And so Medo-Persia, both of these countries, Media and Persia, were under Assyrian domination. But in about 681 BC, the Persians were able to free themselves when a king called Achaemenes became their king. Now, I'll write that down for you on the board in just a moment. But Achaemenes had a son whose name was Ctesippes. And Ctesippes ruled from 675 to 640. And Ctesippes was able to conquer a number of areas that later were to become Persia. But at any rate, Ctesippes took what land he had and he divided them amongst his two sons. And these two sons, whose father's name was Ctesippes, their names were Ariaramnes, and he reigned from 640 to 590. He reigned over a kingdom called Parsa. And then the second son, his name was Cyrus I. He reigned over a kingdom called Anshan from about 640 to 600. Well, it was Cyrus I and the kingdom of Anshan that eventually became the Persian Empire. Now, meanwhile, there was another king. His name was Cyaxares. He was the king of Media. Like I say, I'll write this down on the board for you in a moment. But this king of Media, whose name was Cyaxares, was able to conquer both of the kingdoms that were connected with Persia, both Parsa and Anshan. And when he did that, pretty much Parsa drops out, and Anshan, the kingdom of Cyrus the Great, is what comes to the forefront. And there's an intermarriage that takes place, and eventually what you end up with is Medo-Persia. So without any further ado here, let me write this down on the board for you, since it's crystal clear in everyone's mind. I probably don't need to write it down, do I? Here's what it looks like. You start off with two separate kingdoms, and you start off with Media, and then you have the kingdom of Persia. You start off with both of them. Both of those kingdoms are under the Assyrians when it starts off. And then the next king in Persia is a king called Achaemenes. And Achaemenes is reigning around 681 B.C. Achaemenes had a son whose name was Ctesippes. And Ctesippes reigned from 675 to 640. These are all, of course, B.C. days. Ctesippes had two sons. One son was called Ariaramnes. And Ariaramnes ruled over a kingdom called Parsa. And that was from 640 to about 590 that he ruled over this kingdom called Parsa. So Ctesippes had a son, his name was Ariaramnes. Meanwhile, he also had another son who reigned over another kingdom. And this son's name is Cyrus I. And he ruled over the kingdom of Anshan. And the kingdom of Anshan was around from about 640 to 600. Everything is clear so far. Meanwhile, the king of Media, his name was Cyaxares, reigned for a long time. And what Cyaxares did is that he conquered this kingdom here. So this whole kingdom was all absorbed into Media. And he also really conquered this kingdom as well, but he did not remove this kingdom, the kingdom of Cyrus the First of Anshan. So this eventually is going to become the Persian Empire. But this kingdom is pretty much removed from the picture, and what you eventually end up with is that Cyrus had a son called Cambyses. Cambyses the First, and then Cyaxares had a granddaughter and what happened is that the granddaughter married Cambyses the First. I told you it's kind of complicated, isn't it? And the result of this marriage was a man whose name was Cyrus the Second. And Cyrus the Second is the same as Cyrus the Great that the Bible talks about. Cyrus the Great. And so what Cyrus the Second did, Cyrus II received the kingdom of his father, Cambyses. And so he got the kingdom of Anshan. So the kingdom of Anshan now belongs to Cyrus II or Cyrus the Great. And Cyrus the Great turned around and conquered his grandfather. And his grandfather's name by now is Astyages. So this king right here conquers this king right there, Astyages. And what you eventually end up with is what is called the Medo-Persian Empire. And to make a long story real brief, Cyrus II is the king over that whole empire, which became a very, very powerful empire. So I'll let you meditate on that. Yeah. Sure. If you're listening on tape, then just maybe see someone else's little sketch here that I... Cambyses, yes. Cambyses is the son of Cyrus the First, right.
And he marries the granddaughter, and they have a son who's another king, Cyrus the First.
Yes, right.
And then he takes over what?
And he, what Cyrus the Second does, he conquers Astyages, who's the king of Media. And so what you end up with then, this king conquers this king, and you end up with Medo-Persia. And that's how you end up with one empire, comprised of Media and Persia.
Astyages? He's the son of
Cyaxares. I'm not sure if he is or not. I think
he
is.
Arrow down from
okay, well, he does come from Cyaxares. Whether he's directly his son or grandson, I'm not certain. But Astyages was the king over Media during the time in which Cyrus II was reigning. So there was a battle between them for it was a power struggle. So what it really boiled down to is that Media started off as the stronger empire, and they were the one that absorbed the kingdom of Anshan and the kingdom of Parsa, but eventually Anshan comes up on top of it all, and Anshan becomes the most powerful kingdom, and hence Medo-Persia. Okay, yeah, Karen, I think maybe you had a...
You answered it.
Oh, okay. I did?
Yeah.
Incredible. Gift of miracles, right? Well, that starts way up here with Achaemenes. Okay, any other questions? Yes. Yes. How is he? Well, I don't know how some of these genealogies and everything is really complicated and it splits off and everything, but I don't really know the exact connection there. But what's that?
Take it by faith,
yeah. All you need to do, if you want more information, look in any Bible dictionary under Persia, and they'll go through this for you. Yeah, we'll talk about the more interesting aspects of Persia tomorrow.